Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema. Who were these guys?
Check, check, check. 1, 2, 1, 2. Nice guy A. Nice guy A.
Nice guy B. Nice guy B. A couple of fuck ups just doing their shit.
That was the original name for the podcast before we went with Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com.
.com.
.com.
Dot Russell Crowe. I am, this is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast. So good. It's weird that I just said Russell Crowe because it has to be fattening. I know, it's like, this is unfortunate that these two things, Brian, not intentional.
You live in glass houses.
I'm just saying.
Right, look, when you're talking to your doctor, just tell him you have a spiral fracture of the left radius.
I didn't intend for those two things to follow each other. They just kind of did. I'm Brian Salisbury. I'm a nice guy. And I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist. He's a screenwriter. He's a lieutenant of Megaforce. He's Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
And so Russell Crowe turns to me and he says, so I'm dating this girl. And, you know, I don't know if the relationship would have gone well, but I'm glad I ate her.
Jokes your uncle will tell at Christmas dinner to this day. Oh man, I'm a little proud of that.
He gladiator.
I don't know. I get it.
Glad he a. He might still be drinking scotch from last week.
Oh, it's a nice scotch. It's a nice scotch as we continue.
I don't fuck around with my scotch, buddy.
You shouldn't. You should not fuck around with your scotch. And you should not fuck around with the last episode of Junk Food Cinema of 2018.
Ever.
Oh, by the way, announcement.
By the way, Brian, I'm done.
Ah, fuck. Oh, well, let's just drink scotch. And
Joe Lynch just shit himself. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Joe, no, you want a job?
This is the final episode of Black Christmas.
Oh, Black Christmas. What a fun series this has been.
We are finally done with, I think, every major Shane Black movie we'll talk about until we get around to his Predator movie.
Yeah, or until I finally convince you to maybe bend a little bit and we talk about Last Action Hero.
Maybe, or maybe not.
Or if a patron signs up at that level and may have already asked us to cover Last Action Hero and I haven't told you about it yet.
That would be their money down the tubes.
Once again, it's already happened. So we'll get that worked out. In the meantime, today's movie is... Now, I was wrong because in my head, I had this as the first Shane Black movie that I saw in its original theater. Well, that I first saw in a theater. And then I realized, no, the first Shane Black movie that I saw first in the theater was Monster Squad when it came to the Alamo in 2009. So that was the first Shane Black movie that I had, for the very first time to me, seen in a theater. That was followed, of course, by Iron Man 3 and then The Nice Guys.
Who is it?
Messenger Service.
March, we're gonna play a game.
I think you have the wrong house.
It's called Shut Up Unless You're Me.
I love that game.
You're a private investigator?
Just $20 in there, all right? Just take it.
No, I told you. I'm not here for that. I'm a messenger. I'm not in the yellow pages. If you got trouble with someone, you might ask around for me, Jackson Healy.
I work for the Department of Justice. My daughter, Amelia, is in danger. Please, find her. Protect her.
March, Jack Healy, I'm not here to hurt you, so I'm gonna ask you a question.
No. How stupid do you think I am? I got a license to carry, dumbass. And ever since your little visit, this little baby's gonna stay right here. Don't move.
There's a couple of people I trust say you're pretty good at this. I want you to find Amelia.
You're the guy who beat up my dad.
Sucker punched your dad.
Look at the bright side. Nobody got hurt. people got hurt.
I'm saying I think they died quickly, though, so I don't think that they got hurt.
Yeah, I go back to Last Boy Scout.
Yeah.
Like, I was a little too young to see Lethal Weapon in a theater. I saw that on video right after it came out. And nobody saw Monster Squad in a theater. You know, if you know somebody who actually saw Monster Squad in a theater, they were one of the few. I didn't know it existed until it hit video. And Last Boy Scout, I was fucking there. It was a Bruce Willis movie. It had a Wayans in it. Like, it was so the movie I fucking wanted to see at that moment. It had Danielle fucking Harris in it.
Right, of course.
Who I think we've mentioned every single episode this month.
We may have mentioned her every single episode this year. 2018, go back and listen. We may have done that.
I don't know about that, but yeah, that was a thing I lived through. So, yeah. But this is the most Shane Black movie ever made. This movie, The Nice Guys, has all of the Blackisms, every single Blackism, to a point that it almost feels like Shane just went, you know, if I don't do this in one of my movies,
yeah,
so I better do it now. To a point of almost self-parody, but in the best way, because The Nice Guys is fucking legit.
Oh, it's so good. It's, in many ways, I'm glad that we broke up Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and The Nice Guys with the Long Kiss Goodnight, because there's so much about these two movies that feels simpatico, to the point that there are elements I'm like, if you want to play headcanon, this may be the prequel to Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. There are characters in this movie that I would totally buy if you said to me, that's that character's dad, or they're related to this character from Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Right off the bat, we are introduced to Los Angeles 1977 by seeing the back of the Hollywood sign covered in graffiti. If you want to understand how Shane Black feels about Los Angeles, and you've never seen Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, where he'll tell you, all you have to do is look at the opening shot of this movie. He doesn't even film the front of the goddamn Hollywood sign. He shoots it from the back and there's graffiti all over it in the 70s. Like, there you go. You have this movie has both Russell Crowe and, oh my gosh.
Ryan Gosling,
but it's Kim Basinger, right? Yes.
Also, and Keith David?
No. I'm saying from L.A. Confidential.
Oh, yeah.
So
you got Russell Crowe and Kim Basinger, who are set. In fact, that's the thing is, I was actually going to mention that this is, while this might make a great double feature with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, make an even better double feature with that.
I agree, because even through all of the corruption and nasty stuff that's going on in LA Confidential, LA Confidential has some very rose-colored glasses about Los Angeles. It feels like it fetishizes LA in a way that Shane Black does not.
Well, yeah, but that's very much James Ellroy.
Oh, yes, of course.
No. And for those of you that want to do a deep dive. I'm talking about a deep dive. There is a great 90s documentary called James Ellroy, Demon Dog of American Fiction, which is all about digging deep into who James Ellroy is or was. Is he alive?
James Ellroy?
James Ellroy, has he passed on yet?
I feel like he has to have, right?
But,
I'm going to feel terrible.
No, look it up. But while you're doing that, the movie opens with James Ellroy driving you around Los Angeles and pointing out homes where girls that he knew in high school and college lived, that he broke into their houses to sniff their panties. That's how the documentary opens, is you learn that this guy is a sexual deviant who his tour of Los Angeles is, here's all the girls whose houses I broke into to sniff their panties.
Well, then I guess I am not relieved to say he is still with us. I'm very conflicted about reporting that he is still on this planet.
He's still on this planet. James Ellroy, still alive, still thinking about sniffing panties in the 1950s and 60s. But he had such a weird hard-on for that era and wrote such great stuff about it and obsessed about the Black Dahlia. Like, that was the thing, is that was his obsession, and wrote his great American novel, L.A. Confidential, which then got made as part of Curtis Hanson's great three-movie run, like where he made three movies that it's just a perfect fucking run. He did this, he did Wonder Boys, he did 8 Mile, and it's like, holy shit, what comes next? And it's like, oh yeah, a downward slide before his death. Like, he just hit this perfect 3-movie run where he made the three best movies of his career, all of which are classics in their own way. And that was it. And then, you know, the other things he did were all, you know, middling, mediocre. But yeah, this movie, The Nice Guys, paired with L.A. Confidential, is kind of a mindfuck, because the thing is Elroy in the 90s was looking back at the 50s mm-hmm. the way that Shane Black is looking back at the 70s.
Right. Yeah, and very much with, like I said, I just feel like his view, and especially if you pair this with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, you know his view of L.A. is not favorable. He is very pessimistic when it comes to Los Angeles.
He's got a love-hate relationship with L.A.
And this movie seems to be him kind of hate-fucking L.A. Like, there's so much...
Yeah, but L.A. and Detroit.
Oh my God, I don't think Action Jackson went this hard on Detroit.
Dude, he just goes to town on Detroit. He just spreads the cheeks, doesn't put any lube in, just fucking goes at it. Just like, fuck everyone in Detroit. And
I'm glad I can count on you the more we drink this whiskey. And I'm like, maybe we're too classy.
No, I'm glad no, I can count no, on you. No, we're to junk pull food cinema.
We remind people.
Class is not our middle name. So, in fact, there's a great thing about this movie that there are 2 points in the movie that are big kind of Shane Black fuck yous to where we are, to where we thought we were in the 70s, where you've got this moment where Kim Basinger says, it's Detroit. This nation owes its lifeblood to the big three. Yeah. It owes its life to the big three, and nothing's ever going to change that.
Yeah.
And then instantly you're like, ooh, yeah. So about that.
About that.
And then it's followed up by Ryan Gosling doing what Ryan Gosling does best in this movie. He's a savant. He is very good at what he does and very bad at everything else in his life. And one of the things he says in this movie is, you know what? It really doesn't matter, because in 5 years, we're all going to be driving electric cars from Japan anyway.
Yeah.
And it nails home the theme of this film, as we all know, that the electric car was killed. You know, there's actually a great documentary from, I think, 2006 called
Who Killed the Electric Car? Yeah.
Which I swear I saw at the same festival as Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, oddly enough. But yeah, there, you know, that technology. In fact, the weird thing about the electric car is the electric car goes back to the, you know, the 1900s, where we had a choice between making our cars electric and making our cars gas, and we went with gas because it was more convenient. And we may have had an entire century of electric cars, but instead, no, we didn't. And the power of the automotive industry kept cars the way they were for the sake of the almighty dollar. And Shane decided to make a movie about that while also talking about everything wrong with Los Angeles ever.
Yeah. And in this movie specifically, you got a little bit of Paul Schrader. Like, I got a hardcore vibe at a couple of different points.
You're not wrong. I hadn't even thought about that, but there is a little like hint of Schrader in how gnarly this movie is, because, I mean, Shane's dealt with this material before. I mean, going back to his original script, it's one of the things that I really, the thing about The Nice Guys is the Shane Black greatest hits. Yeah, like, first of all, the main plot line is all about this crime that's linked to pornography. And by the way, pornography's bad. We need to point out that pornography's bad, because that's what this and Lethal Weapon both do. But at the same time, they're human beings, so we need to humanize them. And at the same time, it's actually caught up in a much bigger crime than you would think. Dude, with pornography.
Poll 10 people you know, ask them what the big nefarious plot of Lethal Weapon is. 8 of them aren't even going to mention porn, because it's the setup, it's the opening kill, it's the opening death of the movie, and it leads part of the investigation, but that's not the big bad, that's not the ultimate goal.
But
so most people forget that it's in there.
But that's what happens here. Again, we're going to hit this note quite a few times, because every single movie we've talked about on this podcast that was written by Shane Black, except maybe Monster Squad, but even then we could tie it in with The Precocious Kids if we really wanted to stretch it, is all going to be found here. Like, this is everything Shane does amazingly well on display in one perfect fucking movie. right down to a scene so genius, you've never seen it before. And we'll get there. But this movie takes all of Shane's beats and plays them in all the right ways to where you can do this as a double feature with any other Shane Black movie. But again, I think this is his LA Confidential. This is the era that he looks back on and daydreams about and like takes a deep dive into in this. Like there's a moment where we go to a party and Earth, Wind and Fire are playing.
Do you remember how great that scene is? Cause I do.
I think it happened in September.
I think you're right, yeah.
But the genius, the pure genius of just, hey, by the way, Earth, Wind, and Fire are playing the party. Not the song is it there. It's Earth, Wind, and Fire performing.
And I feel like that's why you can't just say that the theme of the movie is that porn is bad. Because at this porn producer's party, Earth, Wind, and Fire is playing. Like, if this was the grimiest of grimy underground, why the fuck would Earth, Wind, and Fire be playing this party?
There's a lot that he has to say about the porn industry in this movie in a very, like, it's weird what he does. Like, one of my favorite scenes of this movie is where Ryan Gosling's daughter is, because Ryan Gosling, by the way, ladies, has gotten to the age where you believe that he has a daughter that age.
Yeah,
right. And Russell Crowe walks into a room where Ryan Gosling's daughter is watching a porn film with a woman and a guy. And he's like, how dare you show this to her? How could you watch this? He goes, watch it. I'm in it.
Yeah.
Like, she's just proud of her work. And then later on, she's like, why didn't you want to sit down and watch my movie? Like, it's...
Yeah.
Like, there's something... It's what I love about Shane in that he can humanize anybody. Like, he doesn't forget. He's not like, this is a character in a movie. It's like, this is supposed to be a human being, and human beings are three-dimensional. And even if they do things we don't like, they're still human beings that rationalize what they do. And that is all over this about the porn industry.
You want to talk about humanizing? The opening scene of this movie does that in a shorthand kind of way that I was blown away by.
In pure Shane Black fashion, it opens with some kid we never see again sneaking into his father's house, taking a dirty magazine from underneath his father's bed, supposedly to go off and beat it to this girl.
By the way, that kid, Misty Mountains, yes. That kid is played by Ty Simpkins, who was the precocious kid from Iron Man 3.
There you go.
Yeah.
So the kid in a Marvel movie sneaks off with a dirty fucking magazine to beat it to Misty Mountains. And what happens? Misty Mountains in her car drives through his fucking house on the way to her death. And this is where it's so beautifully human and it's so fucking Shane. This is one of the things, like, it's so great. He has literally just been gawking at her image in a way what many consider to be dehumanizing her. He's looking at her as an object. And she crashes. She's in a car crash that is clearly lethal. She looks up at him naked in the same pose.
Absolutely.
She is in the magazine. Same fucking pose. She looks up and goes, how do you like my car, big boy? And dies. And the boy takes his jacket off and places it over her torso so that nobody has to see her naked body. Like, it is in that moment, Shane lays out the theme of what he's going to be doing and how he's going to be addressing the porn industry. He is going to absolutely humanize these characters. You're going to care about their deaths, and you're not going to care anything about the work that they did because that is immaterial.
Yeah.
Like, that is not, there is nobody in this movie, right down to the sleazy fucking mogul, Shadrach.
Yeah.
Hat Rack.
Yeah. And Abednego, I think, is the third one, right?
You know, you are going to see him as a human being that got murdered for something that was much bigger than him, that had nothing to do with what he really did for a living. And it's such a wonderfully profound statement that echoes through this entire movie. This is what we talked about last week. Like, what's your favorite Shane Black movie? It might be The Nice Guys. Like, it's so up there because it hits everything that I love about a Shane Black movie. But there's also a depth to it that a lot of Shane's other movies don't have. You know, like, I love the Monster Squad, but the Monster Squad doesn't have something to say. Same with Long Kiss Goodnight. Same with, you know, Lethal Weapon or Last Boy Scout. Whereas this one, I'm like, there's actually like really heavy stuff here about the nature of corruption, the nature of who we are. By looking at it in the past, you can frame the corruption of the present day, the way people look. Like, Shane has so much to say here, and he keeps playing similar notes like a band does.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like there's an album that AC/DC did famously in the late 90s, I think, that literally they just took all the music for their original songs and put new lyrics on. Like, it was literally the laziest album I've ever heard in my life. And there's something like this to that. Like, watching this movie is like, oh yes, this is every Shane Black movie I've
ever seen. I think it was called Back in Gray. I think it was the name of that album.
It's something. But this is a movie where on its surface you look at it and you go, yeah, this is every Shane Black movie I've ever seen. Like, we're going to go through it beat by beat and hit various scenes and be like, this is like this scene and this character is like Danielle Harris in Last Boy Scout and this scene ties into Lethal Weapon and hey, these two detectives are forced together just like, and it's all that. But there is so much more going on with this movie, and Shane is actually saying something in a way that he's not said before. And that's kind of what I love about this movie, is the profundity of various scenes in this film while he's playing familiar notes is kind of the genius of this film.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like the dichotomy of the two buddies in this movie, because it is, you know, pursuant to being a Shane Black film, it is a buddy film.
And pursuant to Shane Black, here's the thing we have not talked about. Shane Black pairs two terrible people together in every movie. Best character you can find in any of these movies. You have to go back to Lethal Weapon and you have to go to Murtaugh.
Mm-hmm.
But even Murtaugh is like, I don't want to be a cop anymore because I'm about to retire.
Yeah.
Like, he still has that, yeah, I'm a cop and I'm the good guy, but this isn't my job anymore.
Do you know what he is? He is both of the cops from Running Scared.
Mm-hmm.
He's Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines, who are just like, we want to be cops, but not in the dangerous stuff.
Yeah, no. Do we have to really save lives? Like, I mean, I want to do good, but I've got like 3 days till retirement, and I'm about to become a cliche that even The Simpsons are going to make fun of.
Yeah.
But here, like, the thing about what he does in every movie, and I want you to think about every Shane Black movie, because this is our final episode of the Black Christmas. Shane Black treats the buddy comedy like most writers and directors treat romantic comedies. The meet cute is every bit as important as everything else. How these two characters end up together is as important as the rest of the fucking movie.
Lethal fucking Weapon is the best example of that.
I don't know. They're all amazing examples.
But you want to talk about it as a meet cute, like a parallel to a romantic comedy? When Murtaugh thinks that Riggs is just some nut job in the police station and goes, gun! And Riggs is looking around like, who's got the gun? And then he gets tackled. That's a fucking rom-com moment.
Exactly. But at the same time, we've got one where, you know, a thief who gets mistaken for an actor ends up at a Hollywood party and ends up paired up with a detective who's just looking after him because he's making it look like this guy really is going to get this role because Colin Farrell has...
His price tag's too high.
Yeah. You know, they end up solving mysteries together and end up, by the end of the movie, fucking becoming, you know, becoming a detective agency. Like, all of these meet-cutes in all of these movies, every single one of Shane's movies has this. Never so fucked up and violent as this.
And the way these characters are different is fucking fascinating, because you have a character like Russell Crowe, who in this movie is playing Jack Healy, who is just a big fucking bruiser. And that was actually...
The LA Confidential.
You will never in a million years guess that the added weight that he put on was his idea, because he wanted Jackson Healy to be a brawler type, just like a big like monster. And so he's violent. He is definitely the more violent one. And Ryan Gosling's character Holland March tries to stay away from violence at all costs, to the point that if he sees a dead body, he goes full Abbott and Costello. He's like, like literally like that kind of reaction to a dead body. And Jack Healy is doing all of this violence without the auspices of having a badge in the first place. He's not a licensed PI. He's not a cop. He will just rough people up for money. But he is more morally centered than Ryan Gosling's character, because he's beating up people who go after underage girls, who stalk women and won't leave them alone. He's basically what Ryan Reynolds is at the beginning of the first Deadpool movie.
But he also holds up a teenage girl for $7, being $7 short.
And at the same time,
also a piece of shit. I would also argue that these are two characters, one of which has anger issues and the other can't resist a drink. I would argue that they are the 70s version of junk food cinema.
This is profoundly upsetting.
This is really upsetting, isn't it?
In its accuracy. Yes. No, but Ryan Gosling, who is...
Tell me again about your day, Brian.
I won't.
While I have another drink.
I won't. Don't fucking bite my kid. Don't fucking bite. Don't do it. Don't fucking bite my kid. Sorry. I know
That was a little personal, but...
I know you're a child, too, and I can't punch a toddler. I get that.
You want to punch
don't
a toddler.
Don't bite my fucking kid.
You want to punch a toddler right now.
Stargrove.
I am having another drink.
Yes, and I'm... You know what? This scotch that we're drinking is really making me feel better about the whole situation.
It really... It's... Scotch is a magical thing.
It really is.
And which Ryan Gosling understands in this film.
And tries to discover the secret of over and over and over again.
Over and over again.
But even though he's the character who stays away from violence, who is a licensed PI, who does things by the book, he is a tremendous fuck-up, and his daughter will be the first to tell you. He doesn't remember birthdays. He gets drunk at the drop of a hat.
He has a great day, has a good job going on. He's with his daughter, and they have to stop by a bar for a while.
Not only that, you want to talk about Russell Crowe shaking down a girl for $7 extra. Ryan Gosling is fleecing a woman who's paying him to look for her husband he knows is dead, because his urn is on the he knows she's senile. His urn is on the fucking mantle.
Again, one of the hallmarks of all of Shane's movies, that even when people have a moral center, they're doing something wrong. I mean, that's what's so great about Shane's characters. You will never find a Mary Sue in a goddamn Shane Black movie. Like, everybody is morally bankrupt in some way. Even if it's understandable, it's still like, yeah, it's a gray area. Like, even Murtaugh. Mm-hmm. Murtaugh is shying away from doing his job as a fucking public servant, as a cop, because he just wants to make it to retirement. Like, that is the core of who he is. Like, there's something wrong, you know, there's something rotten in Denmark. There's somebody, you know, at the same time, he wants to be young and he's not anymore. Again, hallmark of a three-dimensional Shane Black character. And that is all here. We have this guy who his wife left, you know, who's taking care of his daughter, who loves his daughter, by the way, passionately. He is a great dad in as much as a fuck-up can be a great dad. His daughter is precocious as fuck, is smart as fuck. It's clear that he's given her a lot of attention. And, by the way, I'm one of my favorite small moments about this movie has her drive. She's 13 years old, and she does all the driving.
Yeah.
And also, by the way, solves entire sections of this fucking mystery.
It's funny that Ryan Gosling wouldn't do his own driving, but there we are.
Well, I thought that was a clever...
That's very clever.
Like, it's entirely let's not clever. Have Ryan Gosling drive in this movie. And when he does drive, he falls asleep at the wheel and has the greatest dream ever.
Okay, fine.
Let's skip right to it.
This whole movie has been burying the gun of killer bees in South America. Like, they talk about it, like, it's Chekhov's killer bee. They talk about it a couple of different times.
Okay, so this is... Hold on, we haven't not done this in a number of episodes.
Old Man Cargill, that old man Cargill.
In the late 70s, early 80s, killer bees were all anybody could fucking talk about. It was everywhere. It was on the nightly fucking news. Whenever the kid... Because the thing was, is that these killer bees... were from Brazil, from South America, were moving north. deforestation had dislodged them, and they kept moving north. And for 30 years, they were progressively moving north, and they had gotten through Mexico. And in the late 70s, they were on our doorstep, and they were going to be here any minute. And once these killer bees got here, we were fucked. Like, America was going to be wiped out by killer bees. And as you all know from the history of post-apocalyptic America,
it happened.
It happened. We got white. The bees showed up and we got fucked up. No, they showed up and they're fucked. And we have to be very careful about bees now. And it's not a big thing. Like, if you find an infestation of bees, what do? Well, you call, you know, someone to come and move them, not exterminate them, move them, because bees are important to our ecology. That is something that in the 60s, you didn't have to fucking do. You called an exterminator, they'd come, they'd spray the bees, whatever. But these were killer fucking bees. If you got 50, 60 stings from them, you were dead.
Yeah.
That's fucked.
You were going to get culkined so hard.
It was very much a part of the culture at the time. And it's one of those things that I love. To give you a sense of what it was, for those of you slightly old enough to remember, in the 70s and 80s, it was the Y2K of that time. Like, it was the, everybody was talking about it. Everybody was worried about it. And yeah, it's all over here. There are all these bee things. And he is terrified of the killer bees, to the point that when he passes out while driving and has a dream of being, having a conversation with his partner about how, oh, hey, by the way, just take your hands off the wheel. All cars drive themselves now.
Yeah.
I can't believe you didn't know that. And then the talking bee in the back, like, that moment is like the first time you see that. It's like, what the fuck is going on? And then the bee is in the back talking, like, holy shit, he's drunk again. He is passed out at the wheel.
Did you happen to notice who's doing the voice of that bee?
No.
It's Hannibal Buress. Hannibal Buress doing the voice of that bee. And I remember seeing this in theaters and thinking, wow, Shane Black's going to some weird David Lynch territory where not everything has to be linear. Like, not everything has to be, like, completely grounded. There can be some absurdism and wait, some kind of...
Are you saying Hannibal Buress did this?
Yeah.
Whack.
I don't know. I think this guy might be a war criminal now. It's unclear. Dude, his fucking...
Why are you booing me when I'm right?
He's showing up as the gym teacher in Spider-Man Homecoming and just pointing out, like, everything that had happened in Civil War in one great line, like, we gotta watch these videos. I don't know, I think this guy might be a war criminal now, but we're still gonna do this.
I love him so much.
So fucking good. Yeah, so the bee, fucking, like, Chekhov's killer bee, he just shows up. An actual talking killer bee shows up for this dream sequence.
Well, except it's not Chekhov's killer bee, because the killer bee stuff never pays off in any way, shape, or form.
That's true. I thought this was the payoff for that.
No, it really is. It's just, it's something in the back of his mind, because, again, Shane is talking about this very particular era. You know, he's talking about 78, 79. It is this very peculiar era. You know, disco is in full swing. L.A. is, I mean, this is, it's one of the things, it's so interesting. Kim Basinger talks about it. This is something that's very hard for people to understand in this day and age. Pornography was still very weird. You could have porn theaters and show porn movies. Video hadn't become a thing, so it was just something that would happen at porn theaters. But pornographic films were being portrayed as real films that just happen to have pornography in them. Like, they have plots, you know, and it's like, this is bullshit. But it's like, well, you're in movie theaters. What are they going to do? It's not, you know, it's, you know, they were still doing it.
Yeah.
But the fact is that as the 80s trucked on there and video happened, pornography moved over into that era. But there was a lot of pushback against it. There was a lot of legislation. There was a lot of prosecution. You know, this was pornography. And it wasn't until, I think, 89 that the Supreme Court ruled that pornography was covered by the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, it went from we're airbrushing cooters in porn magazines to, oh, hey, we're showing jizz flopping on women in a magazine you can buy at a convenience store. Like, that was... There was this profound era that me as a teenage boy went from seeing airbrushed cooters to... What the fuck is this? Like, I know that's how that works, but I've never seen that before in an image.
Right.
That's weird. That's what happened in this era. And where what they're talking about here is that last gasp of showing movies in a theater before video, where that was their primary source of income. And there were a lot of people fighting it. And there was people in the Justice Department trying to crack down on porn.
I feel like this is a point Larry David would have gotten to in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang if they let him keep talking. They would have talked about this exact thing about
sure.
How, you know, porn used to be airbrushed this and that, and now why am I talking to you? Invite her to something.
Yes.
Like that's how that
I'm sorry, old man Cargill. by the way, for those of you that aren't familiar, I was a teenager in the 80s. I was born with a penis. I was attracted to women. I looked at magazines that involved them. I know a little about it.
Let's just list the whole CV right now.
So let me get this straight. You made a porno film where the point was the plot.
What's your hangout, man?
So let's break down the other Shane Black components of this, because as we talk about...
Oh, Jesus Christ.
This may be the most Shane Black movie. We've already mentioned her a little bit. So let's talk about the precocious kid of this movie, because as we've mentioned several times before, that is a hallmark of Shane Black movies.
You know, all the performances in this movie are great. I would argue that hers is the best. Like, here is this 13-year-old girl. And as an actress, she was either 13 or 14 when she shot this. Like, she is not 18 playing 14.
Right.
Or, you know, she's...
They're not Tobey Maguire-ing the situation.
She is 13 or 14 playing 13. In all of the same scenes with Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling. Mm-hmm. Russell Crowe, the greatest actor of the 90s and aughts, you know, whose personality kind of sabotaged his own career, which is how he ended up in a Shane Black movie, because typically you have to have completely fucked up your career for Shane Black to go, hey, can I put you in a movie and make you a star again?
Yeah.
And Ryan Gosling, who, by the way, 20 years from now is going to be a junk food alum in the way that we look back and just marvel at his career. He's a guy that should be the A-list actor making $20-25 million a movie. But he went the Brad Pitt route and said, I don't give a shit. I want to make movies I'm proud of. I want to look back at my entire career. And when my career's over, I want to say, I'm proud that I made movies like Drive. Mm-hmm. And I'm proud that I made, God, now I'm blanking on the title of it. The dancing, singing.
La La Land.
La La Land. I'm proud of making La La Land. I'm proud of making First Man.
That's because the first movie that popped in your head was Moonlight and you didn't know which one to say.
No.
Oh, wait, no, that was Warren Beatty. Sorry about that.
Actually, I was the first movie that popped into my head was Notebook. Let's be honest here.
What do you want, Cargo?
What do I want? I want to make another movie with Rachel. That's what I want. Because Rachel's the fucking best. Notebook's fucking great. If you don't cry, you know what? You haven't watched The Notebook since you got married.
I haven't watched The Notebook. End of sentence.
Oh.
End of sentence.
Oh, that's something that needs to happen now, because you're going to watch that.
Are you really surprised I haven't watched The Notebook?
No, I'm not.
Does that strike you as my type of movie, but at all?
No, but what I'm saying is now that you've gotten married and now that you're a dad, the end of that movie is going to bend you over the table so hard you are not ready for what it's going to do to your heart.
Sounds great. Let's go ahead and roll it. I'm just saying, I think selling that experience.
I'm just saying, it's going to emotionally fuck you up, and it's also got Ryan Gosling played later by James Garner. And
do
that is what's going to hook you.
I'm straight. I'm not that straight. Like, that's amazing. That's
you know, it's
casting.
Ryan Gosling is the young version, and James Garner is the old version, and you kind of want to watch that movie now, don't you?
I'm just saying. Nobody's
I'm just
straight.
Saying, and The Notebook is a fucking great movie. I don't care who you are. If you can't cry at that movie, you are made of fucking wood. Fuck off.
I would agree with that. I had somebody tweeted us that they really, really, really hated the movie Elf, and I didn't know what to do with that.
I don't know how to deal with hating Elf.
Because I have the same, what you just said about, like, where's your heart at, how are you human kind of thing.
There's this great thing called Red Nose Day, actually.
What?
Quick trip to the sidebar. It's called Red Nose Day, actually.
Okay, I heard the name. What is that?
What is it is apparently there is this thing in the UK in March called Red Nose Day, where a bunch of celebrities get together and do this whole telethon to raise money for children's hospitals.
Nice.
And you spend one pound to buy a red nose from all these, you know, things. It's, you know, like a 3-cent rubber nose. Mm-hmm. And you could wear the rubber nose all day, like the I voted sticker, and be like, hey, I gave. And it's called Red Nose Day. And what they did in 2017 is they got most of the cast of Love Actually together to shoot a sequel called Red Nose Day Actually, which catches up with all of the characters. And there's actually a moment on it where the prime minister, who's not been prime minister for 5 years, but has just been reelected and is back in number 10, is asked, you know, what's the greatest Christmas movie of all time? And he goes, are you kidding me? It's Elf.
Left turn. That's great.
Me and my wife rewatched that the other day because we used to watch every Christmas Eve. We would watch Love Actually together. And then the Draft House started doing movie parties for where they would just show a 35 millimeter print of Love Actually. And we're like, well, fuck yeah, we want to go see it in a theater. And that's what we do every year now over Christmas time. And it sells out more and more every year to where this year we had to see it like on the 13th. Like mm-hmm. normally we see it like 3 days before Christmas. Like, fuck yeah, Christmas. And now we're like, it doesn't even feel like Christmas yet. And we're watching Love Actually. but out the day after, I was like, you know, we got to watch Red Nose Day Actually now. And she's like, what's that? And I'm like, oh, let me show you. So if you are a Love Actually fan, as me and my wife are, like your Uncle Billy is.
Sure.
You need to check out Red Nose Day Actually, because it's kind of fucking adorable.
Fair enough. Stargrove. By the way, the actress who plays Holly, Ryan Gosling's daughter, is named Andrea Rice. And I agree with you. She gives the kind of performance that feels wise beyond its years. And that's entirely what the character is, but the performance feels that way too.
Yeah. But there's these beautiful kid moments in it.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about this character is it reminds me of this girl I knew at that age growing up. For those of you, handful of fans that read my books, the girl I dedicated Sea of Rust to, Allison, I knew at that age. And she was my geek Yoda. She was the one that grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and said, yeah, you know enough geek stuff. You could be cool if you actually put some time into it. And she passed away several years ago. She reminds me very much of her. Like there's that precocious stuff to her. There's the stuff where she seems wise beyond her years. It's that stuff where she has basic understanding of things that our characters can't wrap their head around. And then there's other moments where she just goes and reads a book and paces around in what should be her bedroom mm-hmm. on the empty lot where her house burned down so long ago that grass has grown there now. Like the dad keeps saying, yeah, we're going to rebuild our house there someday, but it's clearly not going to fucking happen. And she knows it, but she misses that life. She misses her mom and dad together. She misses being in that house. She hates this life now with this drunken fucking father who's a shitty fucking private investigator living in a rental house a block away from where she belongs. And how she deals with that is so childlike. Like yeah. It is not normal. But it's not normal in the way that a child processes it, which is what I think is so fantastic about what Shane's doing here. Again, he's hitting all of these notes that he's played in previous films, but he's adding a depth to every single one that didn't exist there before. Like, there is a lot to love about Danielle Harris's precocious 13-year-old girl in The Last Boy Scout, but it's not this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it doesn't have that extra third dimension that you see here. And keep in mind, that's a Tony Scott film. And I'm saying that this is better than a Tony Scott film. So understand what exactly I'm saying here.
Hear those words.
Hear those words. It's what's so great about this movie, that it's almost as if Shane felt like this is one of those movies I talk about where it feels like it's a movie where Shane thought it might be his last film.
Oh, yeah. Where, oh, I get that entirely.
Where it's like, nobody's going to trust me to do this again. So I'm just going to knock this out of the park and make the best film I can, whether people get it or not. And there's so much more going on here than in so much of his other work that it's almost, it's like a genius album after an amazing pop career is what this movie feels like. It feels like it is this guy making that brilliant album that, by the way, not everybody's going to get, but the people that do are going to be like, holy shit, dude, there's so much going on here that is not, you know, it's like, it's, you know what this is? It's his 10 Summoner's Tales.
What? Sorry, that one went right over my head. Yeah, yeah, I'm not even going to pretend to know what the fuck
you're
talking
about. There
are
people of a certain age going, oh yeah, yeah. It's Sting's solo album that has Fields of Gold on it. And it's a really, really great album that is... You're like, well, you're not with the police anymore, and the police were so good. And it's like, oh, but this is something else, man. This is on another level. And that's what The Nice Guys is. The Nice Guys is just that. It is everything you want from Shane, and yet at the same time, it has a profundity to it that is unlike any of his other work.
And let's take another element of the prototype Shane Black, the black print, if you will. The big bad, or the scary bad, not the big bad, the scary bad. There are two in this movie. Now, you want to talk about Shane Black outdoing Shane Black. Normally, he has a big bad and a scary bad. And the scary bad, like we talked about last week, played by Craig Bierko, Tommy, is not the big bad of the movie, but he's the scary motherfucker.
Are we talking about Blueface?
No. The two in this movie, one is played by Keith David, who is fucking awesome, and I love Keith David so much, and this is
a movie that makes you feel like Keith David is actually 20 years younger.
Yes.
Like, and in fact, there's a fight scene in this that I swear to God is fucking Shane aping Carpenter.
Oh, it's Shane aping, apparently, Russell Crowe's catalog, because there's a combination of moves that he does to knock Keith David out that apparently he also did in Gladiator. Like, they literally just took the two moves and put them back to back again in a visual homage to Gladiator. But he, yeah.
One of these, by the way, sidebar. One of these days, we need to do Gladiator versus Gladiator, where we talk about Russell Crowe's Gladiator next to Cuba Gooding Jr.'s Gladiator.
I have not seen the latter, but.
Oh my God, dude. You're gonna fucking love Cuba Gooding Jr.'s Gladiator. Like, you have no idea how, you're gonna watch that movie and be like, Cargill, we've been doing this 5 fucking years. How have you, almost 6. We're coming up on year 6.
Yeah,
we're like a few months away from year 6. And you've never told me I have to watch fucking Cuba Gooding Jr.'s Gladiator. Oh my God. Yeah. Okay.
So not only do we have Keith David, but we have Matt Bomer as John Boy. One of the most sadistic and awesome of the scary bads that Shane Black has ever constructed.
I love why he's called John Boy as well. They don't like nail that home. He's just called John Boy, and they kind of dance around it. But it's because he's got a giant mole on the side of his face.
They make a joke, and the way it's done is so fucking perfectly Shane Black, because he walks in the room, and Ryan Gosling's daughter's friend is on the phone with someone talking about John Boy from the Waltons, and she says something about a manhole cover on his face. And she's talking about John Boy on the Waltons, and as
Richard
she's,
Thomas.
As she's
from a little movie called,
I have no idea. Richard Thomas? Oh, Megaforce.
No.
You just pointed at Megaforce.
Oh, Jesus Christ, dude.
What?
You've had too much scotch.
No, you pointed at the Megaforce poster.
No, I pointed over at Battle Beyond the Stars.
How can I possibly tell the difference between pointing at Megaforce and pointing at Battle Beyond the Stars?
Because Richard Thomas is only in one of them, fuckface.
Stenographer, read back the minutes. Read it back.
Fuckface, Richard Thomas is only in one of those two fucking movies.
Battle Beyond the Stars.
Richard Thomas was not in The Warriors. Thus, he was not in Megaforce.
Did you just thus me?
I just thus the fuck out of you.
Ergo, Propter Hawk.
Finish him.
Don't you fucking throw legalese at me. You're witness, counselor.
It's Latin, motherfucker.
You're witness.
Only one of us took it in high school.
Yes, that is correct. Now, I will go and not draw my AARP benefits like some people in this room. Stargrove!
Fatality.
Anyway.
Do not disrespect Caesar in this house.
Julius Caesar? Because y'all went to high school together? Is that why you're
there
like...
There were several Caesars, motherfucker. Learn your Roman.
There were several. I know that.
Oh. They all have salads, bitch.
They all have delicious pizza. Don't you worry about it. The fuck were we on about Matt Bomer?
Like, we literally, we hit Scotch Point.
Wow.
Welcome to Scotch Point Junk Food, guys.
Scotch Point Junk Food starring Michael Dudikoff. I don't know why.
I would watch that movie.
This is derailed because I'm watching that movie in my head right
now. Scotch Point Junk Food's pretty
fucking
great.
Second. Ferda.
Stargrove. Nice guys.
Stargrove time, boys.
John Boy is where we were.
John Boy's fucking scary, is my point. And there's a great scene where she figures him out. Like, the daughter, Holly, figures him out so expertly. It's astounding. And he counters that by throwing her friend through a plate glass window.
A 13-year-old girl goes through a plate glass window, and that's the beginning of the action scene.
Yeah, where it erupts into a shootout, where the bullets literally take down a palm tree, and... There is just, man, what I really dig about this movie is that it gets the idea, and I've always said this, that if you're going to do an action comedy, if you're going to do a horror comedy, if you're going to throw comedy into your genre mix, into your genre Cuisinart.
If you're
going to
get the chocolate in my peanut butter.
Do both of those well. Get your chocolate right, get your peanut butter right. Too many movies fail at being an action comedy or horror comedy because they only do one of those things well or neither of those things well. And they think just having the two things next to each other is enough.
By the way, talking about that, that's the big problem with most horror comedies.
Yes.
They think, if we're funny and we put horror elements into it, it's fine. It's like, no, no, no. The best horror comedies are good horror movies and really funny. Like, yeah. Those are, you have to keep them separate and they both, not one won't carry the other. They both have to mix perfectly.
Yeah. American Werewolf in London is as scary as it is funny.
Exactly.
That's what it has to be. And for me, action comedies are the same way. If you're going to lean on comedy so much that you put no effort in your action sequences, then you failed. The other guys. Or no, I'm sorry. The other guys had the opposite problem where it wasn't funny.
Wow.
I'm sorry. Shots fired. I did not like that movie.
That is
at
shots fired.
All. I did not get the love for that movie.
True story.
Whatsoever.
I watched 300 to 600 movies a year. I still have never seen The Other Guys because all the people whose opinions matter to me are like, I guess.
Yeah, it makes a big mistake. And if you're going to make sidebar. If you're going to make a movie about...
We're talking about The Other Guys during The Nice Guys. We're way into the sidebar right now.
We're in the side guys. If you're going to make a movie about the two cops who like live and work concurrent to the high-profile action buddy team, that buddy team needs to be in the whole fucking movie. That's the only way it makes sense. So that they are constantly like living in the shadow. They're constantly, or the comedy of them solving the case and the action of those two guys doing their thing go hand in hand. It's perfect. If you remove the main guys from the movie immediately, then why are we just watching The Other Guys and there's nothing that they are being juxtaposed against. And it just looks fucking like there's nothing that works about that. That's my big problem with that movie, is they don't understand that in order for this movie to work, they have to be constantly in the shadow of the first guys to be the other guys.
It makes me kind of want to do a threesome of the nice guys, the other guys, and the wrong guys.
Hey, the other guys is the wrong guys. That's all I'm going to say. The other element of Shane Black here is your case.
Or just one of the guys.
One of the guys. Your case and my case are the same fucking case. That's what this movie is entirely. Because Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe are hired essentially to do the same thing. Russell Crowe is hired by a girl named Amelia because there are these weird guys following her. She wants them off her back. Ryan Gosling is hired by the aunt of the murdered porn star at the beginning of the movie because she's like, no, I saw her days after that accident. She's still alive.
And he thinks Amelia is the girl that he saw.
Yeah.
So he's one of the weird guys following her.
Right.
What no one realizes is that all the weird guys following Amelia are either Ryan Gosling or murderers trying to kill her because they think she is... because they know how involved she is in this case.
And it turns out, and here's what I really love about the layers and the nuance of Shane Black, is that even though he is making a lot of very pointed statements about the porn industry, as I said, almost going full Schrader at points, it's also the delivery system for the real victory in quotes, but the delivery system for what the good guys are trying to accomplish in this movie is pornography. They are trying to take down a corrupt auto industry that is intentionally suppressing things that would reduce the pollution in America just to save money.
It's a little too expensive.
Yeah. And they're using porn to do it. So really, Shane Black has not created a movie where you can write off porn entirely, because without it, they wouldn't be able to deliver the evidence that the auto industry is corrupt. So it's a very interesting kind of balanced statement that he's making.
But at the same time, there's so much weird, subtle character arcs going on in this movie.
Yeah.
One of my favorites, one of the best parts of this movie, is that Ryan Gosling falls for the assistant of
Kim Basinger.
Kim Basinger's assistant. And through the whole, and from that point on, he's like you get the sense that, oh, hey, that's the reward he's going to get for the movie. He's going to end up with a girl. And then she kills somebody and he goes, she's not really a killer. Are you really a killer? She's like, well, I killed 3 people in Detroit. And he starts arguing that that's not who she really is.
It's fucking hilarious because she has them at gunpoint, and Russell Crowe goes, have you really ever killed someone? She goes, in Detroit 3 times. And then 5 minutes later, Ryan Gosling's like, she's not a murderer. And he goes, she literally just told us she killed 3 people in Detroit.
Like,
yeah, but that's not who she is inside.
And even she's baffled by that. Yeah. Like, it's such a great point about, in fact, oddly enough, about nice guy mentality.
Right.
Of guys who, like, write off these, or girls who write off this terrible mentality that is within this other partner of theirs. And they're just like, he's not really that bad. Like, you think he's that, but that no, deep down inside. And she's like, no, I'm a stone cold fucking killer.
Yeah,
like,
I'm the bad. Straight up told
I'm
this.
One of the big bads in this movie. Are you kidding? This is a Shane Black movie. I'm one of the bad guys. No, you're too attractive and sweet and good with my girl. Like, that's, yeah, it's really such a wonderful turn and a play on just how weak this character is. And again, that's one of the things in this film is, as a true hallmark of a Shane Black movie, both of these characters are deeply flawed.
Mm-hmm.
And they aren't really redeemed by the end in true, like, hey, we're going to get our shit together fashion. They're going to kind of get their shit together. But Russell Crowe still needs a 13-year-old girl not to tell him to murder a guy.
Yeah.
Like, he's going to fucking straight up. And by the way, of all the characters in that movie that deserve to get murdered, it's fucking John Boy.
Yeah.
And she's just like, you can't kill him. Because she cares more about his soul than she does the life of this guy that threw her friend through a plate glass window and tried to murder her and ruined her home. Like, she is like, no, that's not who you are, because she is the warm, gooey, emotional, moral center of this fucking movie. And that's, again, what I love about what Shane did with this is, you know, with Danielle Harris, the reason I keep mentioning this is they are the, you know, they are mirrors.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these two characters are very similar. Danielle Harris is that voice telling us how bad her dad is. You know, that Bruce Willis is just a piece of shit and giving him a hard time and telling him what a bad dad he is and what a bad cop he was and what a bad detective he is, whatever. He's, you know, that's who she is. She is that voice in the back of his head saying, you're a piece of shit, and she's telling us. And while that is this here, Ryan Gosling's daughter is just very much also everything that's right about this movie and everything that's right about humanity. And she's like, no, like, what you're doing is wrong. Like, there's that great moment where Ryan Gosling goes, I just need you to tell me, am I a bad person? She goes, yes. Like, there's not even a beat. Like, it's just, yeah, she doesn't hesitate. He's a piece of shit. And his daughter fucking knows it.
Mm-hmm.
And even when he needs to hear, no, you're a good person, she knows, no.
Yeah,
you need to be told you're a piece of shit because you need to get your shit together. You could be a good human being and you're fucking not.
Yeah.
And that's who she is. And she does that consistently through this movie. And it's really powerful how Shane handles that and how she really becomes, you know, the Greek chorus of this film, of telling us who our characters are and then telling them how to be better.
Yeah.
And it's really, really well done and better done than in any of other Shane's movies.
I would agree with that. And I do think, just to kind of run down the list of, if you want to play, you know, Shane Black headcanon and all of the things that are...
Let's do it. You have a printout in front of you.
I do. So there's a character, obviously, who dies at the beginning of, of the movie, who kind of sets things off like Lethal Weapon. You have the character who is routinely called a fuck-up by his daughter, very much like the last Boy Scout. There's a duck drawing that appears on Ryan Gosling's cast.
That could be a penis.
It's not a dick, it's a duck, which is a line, of course, from The Long Kiss Goodnight. There's also a scene, a great scene, where they're interrogating a bartender, and Ryan Gosling says, tell us what we want to know and he'll stop doing it. He's like, doing what? And then Russell Crowe slams his head against the bar. Rhodey and Tony do that in Iron Man 3 interrogating the Mandarin. So that comes up. Also, do we want to just go ahead and mention the cameo in this fucking movie?
Let's mention it all.
We talked about your case and my case, the same fucking case. There's the mistaken identity of a character, of a female character that's been murdered, very much like Long Kiss Goodnight. The murdered porn producer, whose face is like blown off and he's got a beard.
You can't fucking tell who the fuck he is. He shows up in the credits.
It's fucking Robert Downey Jr. Robert Downey Jr. plays the corpse of Sid Shattuck in this movie. How fucking great is that? Come on. Come on. That's like the ultimate thank you to Joel Silver for everything Joel Silver did for... Yeah, I'll play a corpse in this movie. Sure, why not?
Well, you know, that's very much where Robert Downey Jr. is right now. Like, that's, you know, he feels very grateful about his resurrection. And he's thankful to Shane. He's thankful to Joel. He's thankful to Marvel. Like, he is just fucking thankful. And so, yeah, him showing up in that is great. Also, there's a great cameo by Gil Gerard in this.
There is a great cameo by Gil Gerard in this. That's pretty fucking awesome. He's not hitting on Cargill's mom in the scene.
He's not, but wow.
I feel like that should have been.
I didn't know that you'd remember that or not, but yeah, that is deep cut. Yeah.
Callback.
Gil Gerard once tried to fuck my mom. Buck Rogers wanted to be my daddy back in the 80s. That is a thing that happened.
Oh, man. This is why you should become a Patreon. Patreon.com.
Yeah, if you were a patron, you would know the story of Gil Gerard trying to fuck my mom. true story. By the way, Patreon.com/JunkFoodCinema. For just as little a dollar a week, you can get stories about various celebrities who tried to fuck my mom in the 80s.
He wanted to be Fuck Rogers in the 21st century.
Brutality.
Anyway,
it's Scotch o'clock, and this is what happens.
It is Scotch. So there's a lot of connections, a lot of elements of a Shane Black story, a lot of, like, the, like I said, the black print of, like, the things that are the fundamental components of a Shane Black script are all not only alive and well in this, but really cranked up in an awesome way. And I love the way, very much in Shane Black style, that you get a lot of expectation subversion in terms of what you tend to see in movies like this. One of my favorites is when Holly does the whole, like, room service and, like, you know, there's a gun on her dad.
That moment is genius.
And she takes the coffee pot and flings it at the woman with a gun. And she's all like, I thought it was a good idea.
Well, no. She goes, why did you just dump cold coffee over me?
Yes.
And I spat it in the hallway. I thought it was hot. And then Ryan Gosling just goes, that's a really good idea.
I like
baby.
Where your head's at.
That would have worked out. That might have worked out.
And then the woman with the gun takes a step, slips on the coffee. And they're all of them have the same reaction, which is, huh. Okay.
Like, it is such a great Shane Black moment. Like, it is really that here's a character doing what could be clever, turns out to be really stupid. The other person is so baffled by what just happened that they don't know what to make of it. And then, bam, it ends up paying off in a way that nobody expects. It is the setup of a great joke. It is a great Shane Black moment. Again, what does Ryan Gosling do in that scene immediately after? He slides a pillow under her head because she has pointed a gun at him, almost killed his daughter, and still he's got a fucking hard on for her and has to put a pillow under her head so that she sleeps nicely.
Also another connection.
It kills me. It fucking kills me.
It's fucking hilarious. By the way, another connection to Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is that Jack Kilmer, Val Kilmer's son, plays the character of Chet.
So, oh, God, fuck Chet, the projectionalist?
Yeah, yeah. Call him a projectionalist.
Fuck Chet. I'm a projectionalist.
Oh, like, it's again, so good.
Like, the script on its own, as a script, is just genius. Seeing Shane's execution is unreal. Like, the way he captures 70s LA, the way he puts you right in there, slips you into the filth and grime of not only the era of how he sees LA, and then makes every character in this fucking movie memorable.
Dude.
Every single person who walks on screen, you don't forget from this movie. When you start talking about the scene, instantly you see the scene. Like, it's so fucking good.
Yeah. And not only that, but, like, the attention to detail to getting L.A., even though part of this was shot in Atlanta, to getting L.A. in the 70s, right? Like, the scene where he's waiting in line for gas, and there's the word even on the marquee because it was during the gas crisis. Yeah.
By the way, for those of you that don't know, during the gas crisis, you could only get gas on alternating days, depending on whether your license plate ended in an even or an odd number.
There is a sign in, that has, it's for the Comedy Store, and it has Tim Allen.
Tim Allen is the headliner.
Who was opening there?
There's actually another scene earlier in the movie where they track down over the Comedy Store, and it's a bunch of different, like, it's Richard Belzer, and it's like all the guys who were really big in 1978. Like, this is Shane Black talking about his childhood and talking about Los Angeles and everything that's good and bad about it all at once.
There's also the opening, by the way, we didn't mention this. Shane Black does have movies where he does the character narration. This has two different characters narrating at different points.
Yep.
So again, cranking up the Shane Black of the Shane Black movie.
We Shane Black squared.
That's true. We are Shane Black squared at this
point. I see you like Shane Black, so I took a Shane Black movie and I put it in a Shane Black movie.
X to the Z exhibit. There's a scene early on during Ryan Gosling's narration where they show a movie theater marquee that says Bang Bang Kiss Kiss. It's a porn theater.
Yep.
Like, there's so much, like, all these little fucking details.
This is the Shane Black movie of all Shane Black movies. And it's why I have a hard time picking another movie that I love more than The Nice Guys. In terms of this is everything he does. He knows it's everything he does. And it's him hitting every note perfectly. Like, every single other film, as much as I love every other Shane Black film, there's one or two moments that it's like, well, that didn't age well, or that's not great. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something amazing. All of them are amazing, except for, you know, yours.
Standing by it.
I know you will, and that's fine.
I'm going to go die right there on that hill. I'm totally fine with it.
Aware of that hill being there. but this is the movie that I think that he so understands who he is and then becomes an even greater artist above that. Like, he is the great buddy comedy guy who then went and made a truly profound buddy comedy movie that dissects the buddy comedy movie without being meta about the dissection of a buddy comedy movie.
Yeah. No, I mean, I can't argue with your choice. I think this is an absolutely fantastic movie. I think it is, if you don't love Shane Black, but you want to understand him.
What are you doing to this podcast?
Get the fuck off my podcast.
Like, seriously, this is one of the, like, if we, you know what? We haven't actually said it yet. Shane Black goes on Mount Junk Food.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, without a question, like, Mount Junk Food, if we only had to pick four, Shane Black would be on it without a problem.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
He would be one of the four. Him and Tony Scott, and then we'd argue over the next two.
Yeah, this is true. This is very true. But yeah, this is a movie that will help you understand the components of the engine that drives Shane Black, and it you can blast it all apart and see every one of them taken to 11, and it's a pretty phenomenal time. And that brings us to
the junk food pairing. Well,
the end of this episode, the end of Black Christmas, the end of 2018, and the junk food pairing. Wow, this is a very profound moment here right now.
Is there any choice other than scotch or whiskey?
I could definitely see that. However, there's a scene in this movie that I love so much where after Russell Crowe breaks Ryan Gosling's arm and then goes outside and meets his daughter without knowing it's his daughter.
Oh, shit, no, yeah.
She offers him a frosty cold Yoo-hoo. The next scene, after he says, I haven't had one of these in 20 years, is him carrying a case of Yoo-hoo up to his apartment.
Because he's had it. He's like, why the fuck have I not had this? This is amazing. I'm an adult.
That's what watching a movie like this is to Shane Black fans.
And then Keith David fucking breaks them.
It's heartbreaking. It's
fucking
heartbreaking.
Keith David breaks all the Yoo-hoo.
But that's what this movie is. If you're a Shane Black fan and you haven't watched his movies in a while, you're like, wait, why the fuck haven't I revisited Predator recently? Why the fuck haven't I gone back and watched the first Lethal Weapon? Why aren't I watching The Last Boy Scout? What? These are all so good. I should go back and just get a case of Shane Black movies and have myself a day. And that's what I hope you'll do with the movies we have covered this month. So, Yoo-hoo is this week's junk food pairing.
I concur.
Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on the Twitters and Instagram at Massawyrm, M-A-S-S-A-W-Y-R-M. You can also find me on my new podcast with Dave Chen, which is the Ride Along Podcast, which you can find at ridealongpodcast.com or at ridealongpod on Twitter.
Awesome. You can find me online at Bri Guy Salisbury, or of course you can find the show at Junk Food Cinema. You can also follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show...
I mean, you really like the show enough to notice that we forgot to mention when Christmas happens at the very end of the movie, like the very end of this show.
Yeah, we didn't really talk about the fact that Christmas is sort of an afterthought in this
because
Shane Black Christmas
movie. It's a perfect Shane Black movie in which, oh yeah, right, it needs some Christmas. But if you really like the show...
If you like the show enough to forgive us for that glaring oversight, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, and for as little as a dollar an episode, you get access to bonus content that no one else gets to hear. And we're going to wrap up 2018... you know, we made a lot of jokes, so maybe we can just give you a rim job. Oh, I'm sorry. A rim
shot.
Rim shot.